You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Boulevard Park, home of the Peltoncast, for a special episode. It's end of the year time, and we are going to be counting down, as annual tradition, our top 10 songs of 2018. But first, we wanted to answer four questions about the state of the music industry in 2018. And fortunately, you know a lot more about that than I do.
the people love me talking.
Look, usually we're playing on my home field a little bit, but this time we're going to your turf.
I don't know if you've heard me analyze football games, but
oh boy,
we're playing on my home field every week.
Wow.
But you actually work in sports. I actually work in music. So this is the one episode a year where, yes, I have a little bit more of organizational knowledge, right? Yeah. The background knowledge of what's happening within the industry. And so I thought there could be some topics that we could answer to try to get a state of kind of what it means to be an artist in 2008.
Which you know is an artist in 2008.
Yes. Yeah. Being an artist.
So we wanted to start with something that we're actually not doing this year. In the past,
well, first off, can you ask me the question, what do I do?
What do you do?
Okay.
What exactly is it you'd say you do here?
What was the answer to that question in Office Space?
I can't remember the answer. Man.
So my job in music, this is so esoteric for so many people, right? Like I could say what the job is, and a lot of people listening, let's just take that a step back. A lot of people aren't listening, but the listener may not understand what that job is. So I want to try to explain it just really briefly because my job changed throughout the year. And I don't just want to say the titles without any sort of frame of reference.
I've tried to explain this distinction to various people, and it's subtle. I'm not even sure I totally grasp it.
At family gatherings, I just say that I work at a music venue. It's close enough. Nobody needs to have any further details. But so my job going into the year, I was a booking agent at a national booking agency called the Billions Corporation. What a booking agent is, however, is a person who... So basically, you have two sides of the live music world, right? You have promoters. Those are the people who work at venues, more or less. And they're the
Which
ones...
is what you had done previously before that.
I've worked on a lot of different sides of music.
Yeah.
But so people who are working locally in a city, right? And they're basically buying shows from an agent to put on those shows locally, right? So they're working just in Seattle or whatever. And that's what I did initially. I wasn't working nationally. I wasn't really talking to people in Philadelphia and New York, places like that. Except for the booking agents that I was working with. So then I moved about 5 years ago to become a booking agent at the Billions Corporation. So that meant that I worked directly with the artists themselves and helped them book every single show that they were going to do, and most particularly in North America especially. So if an artist is going to play a show, let's say that you're – who's a large artist?
The Rolling Stones.
Yes, the Rolling Stones. Perfect example.
You said large artist. I thought.
So let's say that you're the Rolling Stones.
I thought of
right?
someone who was doing a tour in Seattle soon.
Yeah, yeah. Most of my top 10 is Rolling Stones songs. On this podcast last year, you admitted listening to the U2 album.
You know what? I went back and listened to it during this process. And the funny thing is I probably did not listen to it at all after maybe January, but still holds up.
Oh, God. They were playing the SNL last night from a year ago when U2 played. And I was like, this is very bad. The Bono was yelling into a megaphone.
That part of it was weird. I can't necessarily defend that.
Anyway, so let's say that you're the Rolling Stones, right? And you're like, I want to play concerts in North America in May to June 2019, right? So then they go to their booking agent. Their booking agent is like, okay, we can play Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, LA, San Diego. Who I don't know where the Rolling Stones are playing. But basically, they go to all those people locally, all of those different promoters locally, and set up the show there. So those people are buying the show from the agent. But the agent is representing every show that they're playing. Festivals, private events, like one-off events. And then that would be like a routed tour, right?
Yeah.
So does that make sense?
Yeah.
Then halfway through this year, I was watching the show Atlanta, which we have a question about later, and I saw Childish Gambino's character Donald Glover's character. What's his name?
Earn,
right? So I saw him being a manager and I said to myself, that's what I need to do.
I got to get on that game because it seems to be working out really well for Earn. Mm-hmm. That was sarcastic. Oh, okay. That was a joke.
So then I moved to working at a management company halfway through the year. And so in artist management, kind of what we're doing is representing, yes, those live shows. We're not the ones who are directly going to the promoters. The agents do that. But we represent the entire kind of facet of an artist's career. So working directly with the artists themselves quite a bit, agents mostly only talk to managers, right? That's kind of their primary contact on the artist side is managers. For a manager, the primary contact is the artist themselves and really helping the artist kind of see through their career, planning, execution. They're doing
just... I often use the term navigate when I'm describing what you do.
So I do a lot of navigating. Guiding, navigating, all that stuff. But so planning out their live shows. And so we would be the people who are going to the agent saying, we want to do shows in whatever, May, June, 2019. I'm Rolling Stones manager, right? That was me as Rolling Stones manager. But then also dealing with their record label, dealing with the publicists, dealing if they have a publishing entity, most artists, especially at that level, you know, dealing with their publishers. Then also doing like the day-to-day work that they're doing, sorting details for their concerts, travel, stuff like that. You're doing everything basically for the artists that isn't literally making
them. Yeah.
So kind of really supporting everything that you're doing. Agents might work with 20 to 30 artists, you know. Managers, on the other hand, it's such a time-consuming job and such an all-consuming job when you're working with an artist, really work with, you know, could be 3 to 4 artists, mm-hmm. you know, that you're spending a lot of time on. And, you know, I think about, like, the relationship that you have and, like, talking to artists, right? Because we're out there having conversations with artists to try to work with new clients, and it's like the conversation with them is just like, do you want a new best friend? Like, you're talking so much about kind of everything that an artist is doing. And there are some managers who are more professional and business-like, and you have a business relationship with them. There are other managers, and we'll talk about this with Atlanta, that are more or less like your friends, that kind of waver between business manager and personal manager.
Straddle that line.
Yeah.
So you would say you're more in the former category?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the groups with which you're working?
I'll talk about them as we get through our top songs of 2018.
As you disclose your biases in that? Okay. Do you want to get now to the first of our four questions? So traditionally, as part of this podcast, we have counted through the Pitchfork Top 10. And I felt like this year, we didn't really need to do that. We already have our top 10s. You can find the Pitchfork Top 10 if you want to. It's pretty readily available. But you thought this spoke to something larger about Pitchfork's place in music and how it's sort of evolved over time.
Well, this isn't the reason that we're not talking about the Pitchfork Top 10.
It is not.
But I mean, that was partially because we were adding context to literally the list of 10 songs where they already have very long descriptions with context about those songs.
It was basically you trying to get me to say whether I like those songs or not.
Yes, that's the reason it started.
Find out whether I had heard of the songs or the artists before.
Yeah, that was fun.
It was. We had some good times.
Not going to lie. You talking about Body Party is still great.
That was the single reason. And now she's Mrs. Russell Wilson.
I know, so which, like, is kind of crazy.
The two worlds of Seattle sports and music came together there.
I think maybe we had a hand in that.
Yeah, I take full credit.
But I had a friend ask me about it after the Pitchfork list came out, the Pitchfork Top 100 songs, which on the whole I think is a good list, right? Like, it's a representative list of what people are listening to in 2018. But I had a friend ask me, what happened to Pitchfork? Right?
Uh-huh. And by the way, I would say a certain type of person. It's not trying to represent the most popular 10 songs, because there are plenty of other lists that do that.
Well, I mean, that's part of kind of what the question was about, though, was why is the Pitchfork Top 10 Songs list full of artists like Drake and Robin and the 1975, right?
I mean, I feel like that's always going to be the case, though, to some extent. Like, it would be really weird if all popular music was also, like, not critically acclaimed at all. Like, there's not going to be 100% overlap, but for there to be a zero overlap would be strange.
Well, I think there's, if Pitchfork was doing the same list in 2003, there would have been artists on it who eventually became popular,
right?
Like, widespread acclaim. But Drake is more or less the most popular artist in the entire world.
Yeah.
And the most popular artists in the entire world would not have been on this list in 2003.
Okay.
Do you agree with that assessment?
I mean, I don't think I read Pitchfork that widely in 2003, so it's tougher for me to say.
But let's say, but like,
yeah, you've got both Drake and Ariana Grande. Like, that's
in the top 10.
Yeah. And yeah, those are probably the two in 2018. They've had the biggest 2018s of anyone.
2018s.
Yeah.
That checks out. And so I think that the answer is kind of twofold to the what happened at Pitchfork question. So in one end of the spectrum, at some point in, say, the last, I feel like 10 years or so, the idea of the like stratification of underground and mainstream music, those lines became extremely blurred, right?
Yes. Like, referring to indie rock anymore, it seems like... Like, is that really a thing, or is that just a genre of music now?
Indie rock?
Yeah.
When you say indie rock, I feel like it refers to a very specific thing, and that almost always is a group of white guys playing rock music that is probably not going to be that popular. Mm-hmm. Like, is Tame Impala an indie rock band?
I don't know. Probably.
The War on Drugs are an indie rock band.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's like, indie rock is like a sound now.
Yes, as opposed to referring to... Actually, you are an independent artist.
Yes.
You can be on a mainstream label and still be indie rock if that's your sound.
Yeah. But so the modern music fan now, right, in maybe like, let's say, the early 2000s, late 90s, you would have had a person who is like opposed to the mainstream, right? And you specifically liked like underground artists. You could almost define yourself at that time by not liking major artists.
Yes.
And now I feel like that's not the case at all. You know, the modern like music fan is listening to such a wide spectrum of music, both genre-wise and popularity-wise, that it's become so much more accessible to listen to Cardi B or whatever, right? Like, the biggest artists in the world also are oftentimes like the most critically acclaimed artists in the world at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that there was always a huge opposition miss. I mean, I'm sure like in the 80s, like Prince and Michael Jackson were obviously critically acclaimed and extraordinarily popular. I don't think this
But those are the artists who've maintained, right? Like, let's say that the 1975 or the Duran Duran, the modern Duran Duran.
Okay.
Like Prince and Michael Jackson, granted, Michael Jackson, they're both incredibly famous, but they seem even more culturally relevant now than they did in the 1980s. Do you think that's true?
They're different in terms of cultural relevance. Now they're legends as opposed to stars. Especially, I feel like it's become both of them even are deceased.
Michael Jackson at the time was a very popular pop artist, and now he's maybe the most important musical artist of all time.
That's a debate for another day. But I still reject the idea that like there was no overlap whatsoever.
Well, I guess what I'm saying
and there's always, you know, like you talking about defining yourself in opposition to what's mainstream. Well, that was also alternative rock, and in the early 1990s, it went from being the alternative to being the default.
Well, that's my question about Pitchfork though, right? Is so the modern music fan is not like when Pitchfork started. And when I came up listening to indie rock, like the idea of listening to like mainstream rap music, it was like I liked indie rap. You know what I mean? It's like I liked MF Doom. I didn't like Nelly or something. There might have been a couple of artists that broke through, but there was this strict distinction to me between these two things, listening to music. And now I feel like that there's no distinction almost at all between those two things. You can equally at the same time like both JPEG Mafia and Travis Scott and view them critically in the exact same light. Right.
So do you think that owes at all to the rise of streaming? Because a lot of the stratification of things, I mean, there's still playlists, but I think a lot of that owed to radio, where stations define themselves with a certain subset of music, and they wouldn't necessarily have that kind of, you go from one end of the spectrum to the other. But if you're listening to a playlist, that's easy to do.
I want to talk about streaming in a second, but I don't think so. Because streaming and playlists, still you're listening to similar types of music in most places, right? Like if you're listening to the Rap Caviar playlist on Spotify, you're listening to a very specific type of rap.
Yeah, but
music.
I think of like when I listened, like I have a playlist that is just called songs, and it's whatever I like, and it's all over the board.
It could owe it to, I suppose, yeah, like the ability to go from, like if you're listening to CDs or records, you have to kind of choose some things, right? Yeah. And you have to choose, like, you're spending time and you're spending money to invest in something. And you're going to listen to those fuckers, like, quite a few times. But if you haven't put in that same kind of investment, and like it literally you have to do something to listen to it. You have to stand up or you have to put in a tape, right?
Yep. I mean, I might not, you know, necessarily, you might discover the music in a specific category, but then you can bring it all together if you want. And like also like you maintain a running best songs of the year playlist that I'll occasionally listen
sort of,
to.
Sort of running.
Yeah. That's going to be everything all together, and I'm not expecting there to be any cohesive theme to it. But I think the other thing you're getting at is that Pitchfork, when it started in 2003, was in the same way that you're talking about musically, it was defining itself in opposition to Rolling Stone in particular. But now that it's, you know, so well in, so established is a music entity, suddenly it becomes, in some ways, just like when Rolling Stone started, it was a revolutionary counterforce, but that eventually became the mainstream.
Yes, Pitchfork is the new Rolling Stone. And I think that's what part of what my question is that, or what the answer to that question of what happened to Pitchfork, is that Pitchfork is so concerned, much like all tech companies are, right? And all kind of major internet-based companies are very concerned, or even not internet-based companies. Companies are concerned, right? Times are changing and companies are trying to figure out, I mean, you can take this from ESPN, right? They're trying to keep up
with... Let's not talk about ESPN.
They're not saying anything specifically about ESPN, but it's a company that's trying to figure out what they want to be in 2018.
Yeah.
And I think that Pitchfork looked at themselves 2 to 3 years ago, right? And granted, they were sold to Condé Nast also. They're literally owned by a corporate entity now. They looked at themselves 2 to 3 years ago and said, we feel like we're representing one type of music fan, but we don't feel like we're representing like the overarching music fan who's listening to all different genres, who's listening to a lot of mainstream hip-hop or hip-hop that's underground but still sounds like mainstream hip-hop.
Right.
That we're not representing this like massively growing world of electronic fans. We're basically representing a lot of indie rock artists. And I think they are very concerned with being left behind in the time and seeming like a relic from a time period that was kind of gone.
Especially with rock music increasingly receding from the center of popular music.
Yes, which I have a thought about that also. But most of the most popular artists in the world are hip-hop artists, right?
Yes.
Hip-hop artists, pop artists. And the modern pop artist is also basically an electronic artist.
There's elements of all of those, yes.
So Pitchfork didn't want to be left behind, but by pivoting to kind of keep up with what the modern music fan is listening to, they're, rather than influencing society, I feel like Pitchfork is reflecting what's happening in society more and more, right? You look at these artists, Pitchfork didn't break the 1975, right? I mean, like, you could give them some credit for Snail Mail and Mitski, who are in that top 10. But aside from that, those are artists that were incredibly successful from places outside of Pitchfork. And so their influence, by keeping up with the times, they've almost made themselves less relevant.
Yes.
Would you agree with that perspective?
I mean, if you stand for everything, you no longer stand for any one thing the yes. same way.
Yeah. Which I don't want to say, I don't think it's a thing that Rolling Stone did necessarily, because Rolling Stone definitely like pivoted to pop music or whatever, but they also still kind of maintain some of their, they never did the thing that Pitchfork is doing where they really embraced kind of what's cool. They embraced what's popular, and Pitchfork has embraced what's cool a little bit more so.
Yes.
And which is probably a good lane for them, but also it still means that they're less relevant, that they are kind of emitting back to people what's already different places.
So in conclusion, the 1975 album, it was solid, but none of them cracked my top 10.
Modern Duran Duran. But so the answer about the, you know, you hear people, you're mentioning indie or rock music not being like the mainstream genre, which is the thing that I think about a lot as like a person who like primarily works in rock music. And there's this sentiment kind of throughout the industry where people are like, rock is dead. You know, there's a lot of like cynical people, typically maybe a slightly older like industry type who might be upset about it. And I really chafe when people say that.
I mean, I think, you know, we've heard Chuck Klosterman talk a lot about this on various podcasts. It would be hard, for all the reasons you just went into, for a guitar-based band to be the biggest band or act, musical act in the world anymore in the way that it was possible in the 80s and maybe even into the 90s, and to some extent the 2000s.
But I don't think that's what these people who are having this conversation are referring to. Like, I don't think they're saying...
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still going to be a market for it.
Like, the White Stripes were never the biggest band in the world.
Probably not.
They were never the biggest artists in the world. They were far from it, right? But it was like they saved rock music in the early 2000s. And artists like that, right? Like at no point were the Strokes, were Interpol, were the White Stripes the biggest artists in the world, were Kings of Leon, right? The thing that I think that people who have that perspective are lamenting is that it is difficult for a group of four white guys playing rock music to be a successful group now. Basically, the story of the white experience, the white male experience, has been told over and over and over again from every single side of the experience forever. And people are less interested in hearing it, right? And I think that's what kind of those people are lamenting, that it's extremely difficult for a group of white guys to become successful in the year 2018. But what that means is that doors are opening up for different perspectives. Like Mitski is a rock artist, right?
Okay.
Is it, yes. Do you not know this? No.
I vaguely know Mitski.
Okay. Mitski is a rock artist who is incredibly successful in 2008, but it's a young Asian female identified person, right? Or Snail Mail, also in that top 10. It's like a like very young, like 18 years old, like female identified person, right? We're just looking at things from different perspectives now, and it's opening up the landscape of what rock music means and what indie rock means.
Okay.
And I think that there's a fear that happens from the people who might have worked and lived off of four white guys playing rock music 10 years ago, but now kind of the future looks a little bit bleaker to them.
But I think the other thing about it is you don't have to be the biggest band, have the potential to be the biggest band in the world to be a successful band.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of room in between there to travel successfully, to get a lot of plays, that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. It's like those people who are saying that, it's an excuse to be late. You know what I mean? Like when I hear that, I'm just like, you're behind the times. Like you haven't, I don't want to say that you need to pivot. You just have to try maybe a little bit harder. But there are plenty of people who are making very nice livings off indie rock.
Mm-hmm. Should we get to our second question?
Okay.
What's the state of festivals in 2018? So this was the last year of the Sasquatch Music Festival at the Gorge. And also recently, a story in The Stranger about how Bumbershoot's attendance in 2018 dropped to its lowest level in years, and not just because of the fact that I missed it this year. So what's going on with festivals?
This is the culmination of years upon years. I mean, we've seen a lot of relatively large festivals go away. A lot more festivals go away than have come back throughout the country. You know, it happened to hit Seattle. Maybe Seattle's the type of city where this would hit it pretty hard because it's not so massive that there's so many people who can go to a festival.
I mean, Seattle is increasingly massive. There's also, I mean, the other thing that's going on simultaneously is the introduction of new competitors. I mean, the Upstream Music Festival.
Which was not, it wasn't well attended either. None of these things were well attended.
But the more festivals that are out there, the less attended probably any individual one of them will be.
I don't think it has to do with competition, though. Okay. Because there's less competition in 2018. Yes, maybe for Bumbershoot and Sasquatch, but like, were there that many people who are just going to Upstream and not going to Sasquatch who would have gone to Sasquatch had it not
probably
existed?
Not.
Probably not. But in general, the multi-purpose, so it's weird, it's interesting to think about kind of these two conversations that we're having, right? The multi-day, multi-genre music festival, kind of like the idea when people talk about music festivals, these like monoliths that really, it's like somebody was like, is the festival bubble burst or whatever? That was like the story in The Stranger. It's like, you're talking about Bumbershoot that has been going for 50 years? Maybe a little bit less than that. But it's like, the bubble finally bursts on Bumbershoot, which I thought was kind of a crazy notion. And like, there was a time, how many years?
1971.
So wait, do some math.
This has been the 48th year of Bumbershoot.
Yeah, 50 years. So the bubble finally burst on Bumbershoot. But the multi-day, multi-genre music festival is doing incredibly badly. And it's not just in 2018.
It was at one point an 11-day festival.
And so we were talking earlier about...
Day 9, they ran out of acts by that point.
That's when things got really fun. So these festivals, they're very large, very expensive, and just kind of competing to have the biggest possible artists. There are a few that are still doing it well and successfully. I mean, like, you know, your Coachellas that were still successful. But there are other festivals like Bonnaroo, which was kind of on the same level as those festivals and just in the similar type of funk to a festival like Bumbershoot or Sasquatch was.
How much of an issue do you think it is? It, like, in terms of getting people to sporty events, it's increasingly difficult because of the fact that there's so many other alternatives for entertainment that don't involve me leaving my living room. Do you think that's a factor at all?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know what the answer is.
Okay.
Like, but the thing is, the festivals that are doing well in 2018, and it's interesting talking about this and talking about the music fan who listens to everything, are specifically targeted music festivals, right? Hip-hop festivals, electronic festivals, small arts festivals. Those festivals are doing well in 2018. The ones that are kind of the multi-purpose include rock bands, include like one rock band, one electronic artist, one hip-hop artist. It seems like all three of those groups of people are saying, this festival isn't for me.
Okay, interesting.
And so it's almost like when we talk about the music fan who listens to everything, I don't think that that's a myth. I think it's real, but I think it's more real from...
It's just maybe not enough to compel them to pay a bunch of money to go to a festival?
Maybe, or it's also maybe more real for people who are for critics and for people who previously were listening to indie rock.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? If you were listening to mainstream hip-hop in 2004 or whatever...
You were just listening to mainstream hip-hop?
Yeah, you were that type of person who was listening to mainstream hip-hop in 2004. That same type of person exists now, and they're pretty much just listening to mainstream hip-hop.
I guess that checks out for me since I was... No, it wasn't just indie rock in 2004, but...
I mean, like, the music that I listen to now is so much more diverse, right? Like, 10, 15 years ago, I would have never listened to such diverse music. But also, it's like, I was wont to really, like, look for things that were new and indie, right? And that type of music at the time seemed new and interesting.
Right.
And now, new things seem new and interesting. But if you were the type of person who... wanted, like, I don't know how to exactly describe, like, the kids, right?
You know, the kids.
The kids.
The backpackers.
The backpackers. I don't think they exist anymore.
Oh.
They're backpacking in the woods now. There are still young people, or there still are people who want, like, an indie rock festival. There are just a lot less of them.
Yes.
There are not 60,000 of them anymore, right? And there's not that many people who want, like, a little bit of SZA or whatever, and a little bit of J. Cole, and then a little bit of Fleet Foxes. Like, that person, there are so few of those, and so few of those people who are willing to spend that kind of money, that I'm not necessarily convinced that it actually exists. But the festivals that have done well are the festivals that have either A, pivoted to kind of being, like, a single-genre festival, or B, smaller, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Capitol Block Party in Seattle is a festival that's, like, 10,000 tickets and has done incredibly well, and especially well, on kind of hip-hop and electronic days. But has had things for, if you were a hip-hop fan, you could find the hip-hop artist to go see. It's also a lower ticket price. It's just like a much more accessible festival and fun, yep. Right? But if you're looking at it and the proposition is paying $130 and you're like, well, I only care about seeing SZA, right?
You're just going to wait for her to tour.
Yeah, just go to a SZA show.
Yep, that makes sense.
So I think it's a dangerous time to be a festival like that. And like something like on the very, very large scale, like at Coachella or whatever, like they're having artists that are so,
right.
And experiences that are so unique to see. Also, it's a pop festival where like if you only like pop music, you can see 100% pop music at Coachella.
Good on festivals?
Yeah.
Third question. What is the most important music company in 2018?
So this is where I want to talk about Spotify. Because this has been the case for a few years, but I've learned this especially now, working in management as opposed to booking, kind of how important Spotify is to, and Apple Music, basically DSP, right? Digital service providers.
That's my first time hearing that particular term.
Just all about Tidal. but there are a few of them, right? But the primary ones being Spotify and Apple Music, they're just more users on Spotify. And that's kind of the one that leads the way. But it's interesting to see just how powerful it is in 2018.
In terms of like making or breaking artists?
Oh, and also how much artists care about it,
mm-hmm.
Right? Like there are artists who would trade a sold-out tour for a look on a Spotify playlist 100 times out of 100. Artists who are going into, you look at the Drake campaign that happened, right? For the Scorpion record, where they had negotiated or agreed with Spotify that Drake would basically lead every single playlist for like the first weekend after Scorpion came out. And it ended up, they drew a lot of complaints because of it from other artists who are involved and haven't gotten the same looks or whatever, or pushed off of those playlists.
So how much do you think that's Drake's side pushing that? And how much do you think it's Spotify realizing that that's what people want is all Drake all the time?
I think it's a combination of both. I think it was a corporate partnership.
Well, between the two entities. Things work, but how much nudging do you think Spotify needed to do that? Or is it something they would have done on their own because it was in their own self-interest?
I think they needed some.
Okay.
But it comes from both sides. Like, it's mutually beneficial for both parties. I think Spotify took a lot more shit for it than Drake did in the long run from other artists. But I think that they were still pushed to do it, right? There are massive record labels behind this, and there's so much money behind it. But it's interesting to see how many artists are going into an album campaign, and the only thing that they're thinking about is Spotify. Now, they're at a major scale, like, they're thinking about a lot of things, right? Like, Drake has a video where he's giving out $1 million. They're spending a lot of money in other aspects other than Spotify when you're Drake. But when you're a much smaller artist, all you're doing is releasing songs and hoping that they get playlisted on Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of artists. And it makes me nervous because I think it's an unsustainable way to be an artist. You know, there's no rule that Spotify has to list you on a playlist. It also, there's kind of become...
I mean, are the artists going to have a say in that?
A say in what?
Like, is creating an alternative path an option?
I think so. I don't...
And that alternative path is title.
What I'm saying is that I think artists need to work on more. And the idea of a Spotify artist, Spotify is very concerned about this themselves. They don't want artists who all they have going on is Spotify in the world, mm-hmm. right? And there are a lot of those that exist. And the monthly listener number is the number that shows up on the front page on the app or whatever. And that's the number that people care about. And a lot of times for certain artists...
This is very familiar to like sports statistics, where it's all about what are you trying to maximize here?
What do you mean?
Like what number are you managing to? And in this case, you're managing to the Spotify monthly listeners.
So like it's like points per game or something? What do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're a basketball player and you want to get paid, you're going to score as many points per game as you can.
Yep.
Because you know that people care about that. And you might be terrible at everything else. And that's the thing that kind of makes me nervous, where it's like some of the fundamentals.
These artists are the Zach Levine of Spotify.
But usually it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it can't be a self-fulfilling prophecy for everybody.
Uh-huh.
So just the idea that you would go into an album campaign or whatever, or like having music that you want to release and basically only caring about getting Spotify plays, is it means that you're trying to attract something that is so tenuous, right? Because there's no, like I said, there's no rule that Spotify has to put songs on a playlist. Also, the listener to Spotify playlists, it's more about vibes than it is about individual artists.
That makes sense.
You know? So like you might turn 1 million listens on a song into 1,000 fans or less. Like those numbers are so far from correlated listens on Spotify to actual fans.
Now this makes me think of Twitter. Like it's all exciting to get a whole bunch of retweets and likes on a tweet and have it go viral, quote unquote. That almost never translates into people actually following you.
Or if they do follow you, actually engaging with you beyond that.
Yeah, or maybe they find out that it turns out that you're not tweeting that one funny viral thing all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like, it was interesting, I was listening to a podcast earlier this year, and they were talking about how basically, like, there's no secret to being successful. Like, there's no cheat code to it. You can't just be like, oh, and then I did this, and now I'm famous, right?
There's no sneak.
There's no sneak to being famous. is that you can, there are ways that artists probably, I mean, you can pay people to pitch for playlists on Spotify. You can get a bunch of listens. Those listens might be in Jakarta, but you can get a bunch of listens and get your Spotify monthly listener number up, right?
So it's like Silicon Valley style.
Yeah. But it's like, that doesn't translate to actual fans and the places that you're making more money
followers.
From. You can't buy plays on Spotify, but it's not that far off from it, what can happen. But it's something that makes me nervous going into music in 2018, that people care so much about that one number, right?
Yeah.
And that's just the be all and end all, basically, of like what an artist is. When there are other artists out there who are selling tickets, right? Who are selling lots of tickets, selling out shows, selling records, selling merch, actually making money from what they're doing.
Having fans.
They have actual human being fans who are listening to their music, engaging with it. But people would still choose this idea of basically getting these Spotify numbers up.
I don't know if this really relates, but I wanted to tell this story.
Okay.
About music in 2018. I thought was interesting. So I finally got Netflix this year and have been watching at long last the series Master of None.
Uh-huh.
And the end of one of the songs in the first season, the song Master of None comes on, And I'm like, oh, this song sounds so familiar to me. And go to pull up Shazam to figure out what it is. And I was surprised because I eventually figured out the reason I know the song is because of the fact that The Weeknd sampled it on one of his mixtapes. And I've heard it like thousands of times and never realized that it was just straight another song by Beach House. But so I finally figured that out.
I probably should have known that Beach House song.
Yeah. In hindsight, but then go to Spotify and listen to that Beach House album a bunch years and years after it was released because of the fact that it was on a Netflix show 3 years ago that I finally watched.
Well, I mean, yeah, if you want to talk about cheat codes, getting a major sync is like the biggest cheat code you can find.
But I just thought that was like a fascinating example of what music is like in 2018. A similar thing happened with the Barry theme, Change for the World by Charles Bradley.
Huh?
Yeah, from who is now passed away. From an album that was a couple years old, had never heard him before, but then like it immediately became one of my favorite songs because of the fact that it's like such an amazing theme song on Barry.
Oh yeah, I mean like I said, a major sync is that's a way to boost fans.
But I just think it's fascinating because like in years past, you would have to like randomly. I mean, not this is like way long ago. I'm thinking, but you would like have to like randomly find out what read about what the theme song was, and then you'd have to go buy the album.
It's definitely easier.
Like 2018, it's within 5 minutes.
I mean, everything is easier, but that's part of what I'm saying.
But everything is also harder.
Everything is harder because it's harder to stand out as an artist, right? So like, what Spotify has done by having so many playlists, right? Playlists with a lot of followers, some of them, has meant that artists who are smaller could hypothetically find themselves on these playlists, right?
Uh-huh.
It's almost like it makes a level playing field for newer artists where you can compete with people who are a little bit more established, might have labels, might have bigger distribution deals or whatever. But it also means that you can get to these points without having any sort of the like
the fundamentals.
Yeah, the fundamentals, the ground level of the pyramid that's happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I also just think about it where it's like an artist can seem like a very big artist. And I think we'll see this a lot going forward in the next couple of years. Artists who seem like very big artists but don't have those same kind of fundamentals and their careers are just going to crater.
Yeah.
Because at some point, Spotify is very interested in new and artists can feel tired extremely quickly.
You're going to like cycle through things in a hurry.
Yes. Because there's always new music and they're seeing a bigger volume of songs than the world has ever seen before, right? Like they're the most overwhelmed and they're also trying to treat music basically like they're trying to program music, yes. Right? Because you have to. There's such a high volume. It's not that Spotify doesn't want the personal element. It's just that they're getting such a high volume of music that they couldn't humanly sort through it all, right? Without this massive team of people. But what it does...
That's what I rely on you for.
Is...
Since I don't listen to Spotify playlists.
It's all Spotify. Me just regurgitating Spotify. No, actually. I'm one of the few stories blogs. But the other thing that it does is, and this is another thing that makes me nervous, is literally what Spotify is doing is saying that it will promote things that basically have like a low like change rate, right? People hear a song on a playlist and they listen through to the song and then they add it to their library or whatever, save it. And Spotify will take those songs that do really well on playlists and put them on more playlists, right? And give them more promotion. But so what that does is it literally means that a computer program is basically refeeding people what they want, right? It's almost like an echo chamber that's happening where like
that's the entire internet.
But what it means is that there are parts of the internet where people see heaps of things that might push them mentally. But at Spotify, that's not happening. Spotify is weeding out things that might...
This sounds exactly the same as YouTube and what we've learned about Facebook. We've learned about this a lot about a lot of media companies that have a lot more problematic impacts in 2018.
Okay, but you're telling me those are companies that have problematic impacts. That's the same shit that I'm saying. I'm not saying it doesn't have a problematic impact because we're talking
about... Spotify's going to influence an election.
We're talking about pop songs here, right? But if that's what's happening, it's that everything basically gets regressed to the mean, right?
No, it doesn't get regressed to the mean. It's that...
I think about when you do your projections, right, every year, your projections always weed out outliers, right? You would never project a team to win 70 wins in basketball.
Yes.
And that's kind of what they're doing. It's just like
taking
the average.
What they're doing is they're taking these small differences and magnifying them because the small difference gets like squared. So like a song that's slightly more popular on the playlist than the other, because then it goes to more playlists and it's slightly more popular, and so on and so forth. It keeps building upon itself. It's a virtuous cycle, unless you're the victim of it, in which case it's a vicious cycle.
don't you think that means that music that might be a little bit more difficult, though, a little bit more progressive, might have a harder time?
Yes, but I think that's because that's what people want. And I think one of the things that people... I think the problem that people have with algorithms on the internet is they reveal the things we don't want to be true about ourselves.
I don't know if that's true, necessarily. Like I think about artists that do quite well at the place. I don't know, it's tough because press can basically be bought, right? Anyway, it's an interesting thing to think about.
So speaking of artists who are trying to make a career and sustain that early success, Paperboi, fresh off the success of Paperboi, dropped his album, had a great success. How accurate is the TV show Atlanta?
100% accurate, is it? I mean, it's very different than my experience as a manager.
You've never hidden a gun for anyone?
The world of hip-hop is very different than the world that I am living in. And even the artists that my company, that are more hip-hop artists, the relationship that those people who are working with the artists have a much more similar relationship that Earn and Paperboi have, right? It's closer to a friendship or where you're making kind of like day-to-day needs, right? I'm working with people on a professional level, you know? But in hip hop, kind of the standard for management is less about finding like a professional manager who can grow opportunities for you or whatever, and is more about finding basically the most businesslike person that you know and having that person kind of run your day-to-day life. Because there are other people out there to grow your business too, you know? Like, you can still sign with major agents and major labels or whatever and have those people deal with that. You might have a little bit less vision to it, but those people exist. And in hip hop, Earn is what a manager is for most hip hop artists. And it's kind of amazing how accurate it is. I mean, I think about there, you don't see enough of the business.
Yeah, I mean, one of the complaints that people had about Atlanta is like, oh, Paperboi's never recording music. Like,
he is recording music. He's down there with the Yoohoo guy.
Yeah, but but I think that the point is that show is only showing you a sliver of the life. It's not like the show 24 where you get the whole day in the life of Paperboi.
But it does feel like, and like the pressure and pull, right, of a person who people who are just like, have your manager get you stuff, right? Like all these things exist in the world. And it's just kind of crazy how Donald Glover sees it so well. But also, he is a successful hip hop artist.
Yeah, I mean, he's lived it.
So, I mean, I think that Donald Glover, basically his entire career, has lived in a very different world than Paperboi has lived in.
Yes.
Given just the circumstances of his career and where he started, it's been very different. But he has seen it so many times and seen that experience. But even just like the industry plant thing, right? What is that kid's name?
The Yoohoo Git?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I'd have to look it up.
It's like that is something that Donald...
Oh, Clark County.
Clark County, yeah. Donald Glover has seen that type of artist, right, who might be working with slightly more professional management, and they're going out and like getting him these opportunities and getting him the Yoohoo commercial or whatever.
Damn catchy song. Yoohoo.
But what Earn does is a very common thing, including all the way down to, it's like, we don't ever see Paperboi's agent, which Paperboi would obviously have an agent who would have negotiated the college show that he ended up doing at the frat.
For no money?
For no money. But his agent would not have let him play that show for no money. But
that was the least realistic thing on Atlanta.
A manager, let's say that for some reason Paperboi doesn't have an agent, right? He hasn't signed with an agent yet, which would not happen. But given, I mean, just trying to understand how popular it is. But if you took a manager, managers almost always will do things for the potential of future money, right? Of like growing an artist way more than an agent will. And you see that and you're like, I can see how Earn got here.
Yeah. Can I give you like an extremely inside Pelton Cast Seattle sports thing about the Clark County Yoohoo song?
Okay.
I think about it every time that I see Sounders left back Yoohoo play.
Oh, yeah.
Yoohoo.
It's kind of amazing, though. I mean, that's the best part. Like, everything about Atlanta is amazing.
The fact that the songs are like legit.
The songs are legit, but
I mean, it's not surprising.
Even down to just the fact that like the relationship, right? From a music industry perspective, and look, maybe if I was a hip-hop manager in Atlanta, I'd be like, that's bullshit, that's bullshit, that's bullshit, right?
But from your perspective, it feels very real.
It feels very real.
All right, we've answered all the questions that there are to have about music in 2018, except the most important one, that being, what are our top songs of 2018? Do you want to start? Do you have any honorable mention?
Well, so I was thinking about the Spotify thing.
You're talking about your like 10 under the radar songs.
Yeah, I'm not going to do these. I'm not going to do these right now. But I'm just going to say those will function as my honorable mentions. That makes sense. So what I wanted to do is I have my top 10 songs, but I also wanted to choose 10 songs that are outside of maybe haven't gotten the same kind of Spotify as some of these other songs have gotten, haven't been boosted up in the same sort of way, haven't had the same kind of money behind them. So I wanted to choose kind of 10 songs that were a little bit smaller, kind of newer artists, but we'll go over those after we do our top 10s.
All right, so I had two honorable mentions. Oddly enough, one of them was in fact Childish Gambino, Feels Like Summer, and then the other one, which may or may not appear in your top 10, Reborn by Kid Cudi and Kanye West.
May or may not appear in my top 10.
It definitely will.
It definitely will.
I just couldn't in the end bring myself. I was on the fence about it, and I couldn't in the end bring myself to put a Kanye
song.
You
saw Stephen Miller earlier today. I'm good.
Okay. Do you want to do your number 10?
So at number 10, this is the number 10 spot is always the nepotism spot. I work with this artist.
Baby Fantasy Genius put out an album this year.
It's him scatting. At number 10, I have the band Illuminati Hotties and their song You're Better Than Ever.
What a breakthrough year for Illuminati Hotties.
Just great management.
So, yes. So many like best of 2018 mentions. I know only because you retweet them all.
I was going to say, you probably see them more. if there was another artist who all of their best of 18 mentions were being retweeted at you or whatever.
Yeah, weirdly that's not happening with anyone else. All right, my number 10. I wanted to go with something from I think this is the lone indie rock entry in my top 10
really?
This year. Death Cab for Cutie put out an album that did not probably have the impact of many past Death Cab's albums. I think that like the song that they were trying to have really like have a local impact was Gold Rush, which is about changes in Seattle. But I never took to that one. I heard it this morning on the radio when I was driving to your house, and I was like
KXP.
Yeah. I was like, this is just a little too anti-change for me. I'm out on this. So instead, I went with the song You Moved Away, which was about local Seattle like artist and music figure Derek Erdman moving back to his native Chicago in 2017.
Derek Erdman?
It is, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was my top song off Thank You for Today.
I did not know that Death Cab for Cutie had such a strong relationship with him.
If you listen to the lyrics, very clearly, yes.
Okay. We're going to talk about that one more offline.
Do I remember this guy doing the rapping, like he like raps messages you want to deliver to people? Was that a thing?
He didn't really do that in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
He does. You would definitely recognize his artwork.
Oh.
His artwork is in a lot of places.
Number 9. I
learned two things. I learned that Death Cab for Cutie put out a record this year.
Did you not know that?
I don't know. I actually.
Oh, my goodness.
At number 9, I had the song Controller by Channel Trace.
Okay.
A song that I read about it. There was press the first day that it came out. And I read about it before I listened to it. And I was like, this song's going to be a jam. And it was a jam, right? Basically house music with like a little bit of hip hop laid over it, right? Super repetitive. Exactly what I'm looking for. And I am the controller.
My number 9, the first of many appearances from this album, which was the Black Panther soundtrack.
I do. You're going to be all about it. But everybody else has forgotten about it. You have not.
It's all of 2018. I can go all the way back to, did it come out in January or February? February, but
that seems about right.
I remember listening to it a lot around All-Star Weekend in particular. But at number 9, Pray For Me by The Weeknd and Kendrick Lamar.
I mean, that was like around Coachella. I feel like all the stars, you said All-Star Weekend?
Yes.
All-Star Weekend, like Coachella, it was definitely lingering. And it was like the first few months of the year, the Black Panther itself,
yeah,
and the Black Panther soundtrack were like, it was the pop music of the year.
Yeah, and deservedly so.
Well, I'm happy that you remember it.
Pepperidge Farms remembers.
At number 8, I have the song Nice For What by Drake.
Okay.
It was kind of taken over a little bit by the rest of Drake's year because it was a single that came out before Scorpion came out.
Yeah.
And I heard it in the Lauryn Hill sample and you're just like, okay, I'm definitely in on this. This was like supposedly the first edition of Woke Drake.
Where did this appear? This was in the Pitchfork top 10, right?
It was, yeah, it was like number 4 or 5 in that top 10.
I seem to have lost. Oh, no, I don't. I still have it here. Yeah, number 4. Nice For What.
But it was, it's the song to me, like, it's, I mean, a lot of these songs, doing the top 10 at the end of the year is tough because songs,
that's why you gotta adding over the course of the year. You can't have too much recency bias. Yeah.
That's why I had this in there, though. Okay. I was like, I remember how many times I listened to this song in April or May or whatever.
This one did not crack my top 10. At number 8, I had Chances from K-Tronada featuring Shay Leah.
Wow.
Still waiting for K-Tronada's follow-up to the 99%, which was my album of the year in 2016. But he dropped a couple of singles at the end of November, and this was my favorite of the two of them.
Recency bias. Have you listened to the Chance the Rapper songs?
I have. I didn't dislike them, but I didn't love them.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Man, the man who has everything. Just the line where he raps about, he's like missing Fatima, he's talking about No Name, and I'm just like...
Yeah, maybe in time. I mean, you know, when I think back to the coloring book, I don't feel like that grabbed me right away. So maybe with more play, it will jump up for me. But none of them really threaten the top 10.
At number 7, I have a song from 2017, but I didn't become a fan of it until 2018. So it counts by the official
dubious.
The official rules.
You usually complain about me putting songs for the previous year.
I thought that's just what we were doing now. The song Ric Flair Drip by Offset and Metro Boomin. My God. I mean, this was, you know...
How much credit are you giving them for the video with Ric Flair?
A lot of credit. It was probably the happiest that Ric Flair has been in a long time. Being able to go to that video and have the song, like, have his name in the chorus, he was very excited. But this, to me, was like, it was Migos' year, right? Like, you talk about Drake and Ariana Grande, but, like, those are artists who exist in a different stratosphere.
They had already been there. Migos ascended to that level.
Migos, they ascended near that level. They were still opening for Drake on the tour.
To their current level.
But the Migos and Cardi B year that those two artists had was, it took them from being like bubbling artists to being legit in the same kind of realm and family. And it's just like...
Perhaps not Migos and Cardi B together anymore.
And we'll see. And I heard that Offset was on stage begging for Cardi B to take
it. It wasn't well-received by all accounts.
Oh, no.
It went poorly.
But their story has to be told together. Their rise has to be told together in some capacity. But this song, it's just like the music. I was telling this to the famous Cousin Katie a couple weeks ago. It's like Migos is like pretty sinister for mainstream pop music, just like dark tones. And the same with this track. And it's just like very Atlanta.
It's also authentic to Atlanta, which you have never been to.
Yes. Yeah.
At number 7, I had an artist that you work with, Ballin' by Paris Alexa.
There we go.
So I first listened to this in advance of going to see Paris at the Capitol Hill Block Party and immediately recognized it as a jam. It's also like amazing live. We went to go see her a few weeks ago at, what was the venue in Capitol Hill?
Chop Suey.
Yeah. And the video of Sean Kemp and Gary Payton highlights playing at the same time. Is it like, come on, you can't get any better than that. Even though Paris was definitely not born when Sean Kemp played for the Sonics.
That's probably true.
Oh, it's 100%
true. 100% true. But the only way that you can listen to that song is with highlights of Sean Kemp and Gary Payton.
It would be a those waste to not do so.
The only people who have ever been balling.
To that level, certainly.
At number 6, I have the song Come Over by the Internet. If I could choose to manage one group in the entire world, it would be the Internet. I already managed the Rolling Stones earlier. It's just like the diversity of what the internet can do. So many different things. They all went off and released within the last couple of years solo records that were excellent on their own. And then they came together and just like released this. You just looked up the, you saw Al Gore. You're like, tell me more about this internet.
I know, Sid. Don't worry about it.
All went off and released excellent records on their own and then came together for the most laid-back record of the year. Like, super in the groove, right? Just all vibes the entire time through. Excellent.
I like a nice vibe. At number 6, I had the second song off of the Black Panther soundtrack. The Ways from Khalid with Swae Lee.
All right. I listened to that record a lot.
Yeah.
You and Baby Fantasy Genius are about that Black Panther soundtrack. He told me yesterday, I was telling him that I had watched the Avengers movie,
yeah,
Infinity War, and he was like, the only superhero I like is Black Panther. And I was like, that's what's up.
Good parenting. So,
yeah, I took a lot of credit for it. My number 5 song is the song Sicko Mode by Travis Scott featuring Drake.
Okay.
it's almost like you get three songs in one.
Yeah.
Right? With all the changes happening. I mean, the first time you hear this, you're like, okay, this is cool. This is cool. And then you're like, mind blown. And then you're like, mind blown again. This was like the best song that money could buy.
And did. All right. At number five, I had one straight off of your best of 2018 list, but I would never have heard otherwise.
I'm fascinated.
What Does It Take by Miljon? Oh, yeah. I have no idea how you pronounce that. A Swedish duo. There's like this intensely long buildup to the lyrics in the song, and it's just great. I love it.
I thought about putting that in my...
Your obscure top 10?
Yeah, obscure top 10.
I guess it wasn't that obscure after all, since it cracked my top 10.
At number four, I have the song Heels by Sir Baby Girl. And this is a very wild one in my mainstream hip hop top 10 here.
I don't know this song.
I was driving to work and definitely not reading my phone while I was driving to work, of course. I was driving to work over the summer and saw people tweeting about this song. I mean, it's a tiny song, right? It's like less than 100,000 plays, if you can believe it, on Spotify. And immediately, I never turn off the podcast that I'm listening to listen to music. It's a very rare thing. And I was like, I need to hear this.
Usually you're listening to us. Just like, oh, that was a great joke. Oh,
good point you make. I only listen to the me half. I talk over you talking. And I just like, I turned off the music, or I turned off the podcast, like found the song the second it came out. And it did not disappoint. I'm like singing along instantly. The song, jam. The full record's not going to be out until 2019. So it'll probably be on that list then.
Good, good. All right. My number four was going to Cardi B.
Is it going back to the Black Panther soundtrack?
Yeah. No, that's still coming. That's still coming. Don't worry about it. There's a third.
I feel like the Black Panther soundtrack didn't fare very well in end of year lists.
No. Again, it was forgotten. But I went with Be Careful, which... I love that like Cardi like really sings on this song. It also takes on a very different tone now that you know about her breakup with Offset. So it turned out he should in fact have been careful and probably was not.
This was really the year of the term drip, where it's like all these artists, like it's like you hear the term and it was definitely like a Cardi B Migos term, right? And then all of a sudden like Lil Yachty has a song called Drip and I was like, that's how you know he's an industry plant. At number three, I have the song Pickup by DJ Coetzee.
Okay, so this was in the top 10 on Pitchfork. It was one of the songs I had not previously.
It was like, I remember reading it, and I fully heard the song from Pitchfork over the summer at some point, listening to it and being like, that's cool.
I thought they were over.
And then listening to it, you can still find good songs in the track section.
Okay.
That's it.
Or in the top 10.
And then listening to it this last week, it's like, it's all I'm listening. And it's like, you can tell that he's a producer who's been around for kind of the last three decades. It has a lot of the sort of like early 2000s sensibility of electronic music.
My number three, the last of the three songs for the Black Panther soundtrack, is All the Stars with Kendrick Lamar.
I thought that might have been number one.
Just you wait for my number one. I feel like I have... I don't want to say a love-hate relationship with Kendrick Lamar, but I'm not like as high on most of his music as most people, but when I really do like a Kendrick Lamar song, I really like it. So I think he came in number two a few years ago with I. So
did you just say hate relationship with Kendrick Lamar?
It's an expression. It's a figure of speech.
Be careful.
Thanks, Cardi. So this one really hit me. And it was like, I wanted...
It sure did hit you.
When I was at All-Star Weekend, I wanted every song to be All the Star at that point. It seemed perfectly appropriate for it.
It really didn't fare all that well long term.
Yeah, it didn't have the longevity that you would have expected. Maybe it's too early. Maybe it was too far before the summer. But it should have dominated All-Star Weekend.
The thing is, you never realize what the song of a season... Like, you never realize how much the song of the next season is going to roar in and take over your...
Yes.
Does that make sense? And it's almost like...
I'm always going to keep listening to whatever the current song is.
That's kind of the magic of it, though, right? When it hits you, and it's just so all-consuming for that time period, and you're like, this is the only song that I want to hear. No matter how or where I hear it, I will always turn up in that moment.
Yes.
And that is my number two song.
Is it?
I heard it on draft night.
Oh,
for the first time ever. And I didn't think, I was like, oh, that's kind of a weird song. That's pretty good. And then lo and behold, a couple months passed and I'm in arenas every single place. And there's Mo Bamba.
really the highlight of Mo Bamba's career, which has been fine.
This was the year that Pete Davidson got a song named after him on the Ariana Grande record. And somehow the name that will be most remembered by a song will be Mo Bamba's name by Sheck Wess. This song is hot. Still, and I've heard it 1,000 times.
All right, my number two, Heaven's Only Wishful by More and More.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, maybe you can fill in the backstory a little bit more on More and More. Pun was actually not intended there. So I had definitely heard this from you, but I can still remember, like, I was driving to South Center and heard it on the radio and was like, had to make sure I looked it up because I'm like, this is a jam. And it's just a jam, man.
They played it on KXP?
Yep.
All right. So the first night that I heard the song, this was when I was at the booking agency and had chatted with the manager of More, completely unknown. He'd released songs like 2 years ago that had been scrubbed from the internet. So there was nothing. The only place they would have found it is if you knew the management company's website. Heard this song from the manager. And like when you listen to a song without any context, it's almost hard to judge, right? And then you're just listening to it and it's like, the first time I'm like, that's kind of cool. And then the second time you're like, oh, that's interesting. And then the third time you're like, oh shit, this might be a thing. And that was definitely one of those songs where it was like, I kept listening to it. And this was before, like the song came out like the Friday. We heard it on like a Wednesday and it came out on a Friday. You definitely heard it like the first day. You probably heard the song before it came out. You just don't remember it. Because we were recording a podcast the first night.
Oh, were we?
Yeah.
I was connected to it. We went to a concert, but I guess that was back in 2017, so that wouldn't have been it anyway.
No, this was like, I don't know, February, March or something.
Okay.
And it's like so many elements of so many different things.
It's the catchiest song. Like you've got to be prepared if you're going to listen to Heaven's Only Wishful to have it stuck in your head for several days afterwards.
And there's a song called Waiting on the Warmth Now by More and More. Initially it was called Waiting on the World. It's like really quiet and then this huge chorus hits. God, where did that come from? Another song though that you're like the first time that I heard it, you're like, where did this come from? It's like ingrained into your soul right away. And that is the song Reborn by Kid See Ghost, Kid Cudi, and Kanye West.
Not only was it in your top 10.
There's no chance of any other song being my number one song. I've gone through a lot of emotions this year being a Kanye West stan.
Getting made fun of by being right? Fantasy Genius.
That was a low. I've felt a lot of feelings. I've listened to probably more Kanye West songs than I should have listened to in the year.
As long as it's more than you've read Twitter rants by Kanye in 2018.
I've experimented with shunning Kanye and just fully standing Frank Ocean solely. Just having that be my number one.
Didn't take?
If you wanted to talk about the songs that I've listened to the most in 2018, all of Blonde is in the top 10.
Okay.
Which I think is the best record ever. But the first second that I heard Reborn, I was just like, this is the song forever. This is it. I mean, it is so close to me, like kind of like just like the vibe and the mood over it, like Real Friends by Kanye West. That was my favorite song in 2016, number one track in 2016. It's like this is the cultural heir apparent to Real Friends is Reborn.
Uh-huh. All right. My number one for the third time in the last 4 years, Drake tops my list. But it's not Nice for What.
Uh-huh.
It's not God's Plan, which was in my mid-year top five.
Okay.
It's not even In My Feelings.
Wow.
Which subsequently blew up and was plausibly the song of the summer. It is instead an album cut.
There we go.
From Scorpion.
I definitely don't even know the song.
Summer Games, which is not one of the six Scorpion songs in the popular section of Drake's page on Spotify. But when I went back and re-listened to Scorpion, when I was like first starting to think about my top 10 of 2018, like maybe October or November at some point
we put time into this.
For sure.
I did my top 10 while we were sitting here right before.
You've
been working on this since October.
Crafting it for months. Waiting back, obviously dating back to February. So there's like two types of Drake jams. There's the anthems, of course, that are usually the songs of the summer. And then there's the introspective mood songs. Kind of like Marvin's Room, that kind of classic song.
What do you consider In My Feelings?
It's somewhere in between. But this is my favorite ever introspective Drake song.
Really?
And like all Drake songs, I can't totally vouch for the lyrics because they're problematic in some cases.
Always a little bit problematic. Just a little bit. Drake is still like, there's still a little questionable.
But it's still so great to listen to. And the vibe, to go back to your term. You invented that term.
Yeah, vibes. I invented
it's
vibes.
Just an amazing vibe. I love it so much.
What is the song called?
Summer Games.
All right, that's today.
Yeah. So it was three times in the last 4 years that Drake has been number one. The other year, he was number two.
God.
Drake, he like knows his target audience, and it is big.
You have to be impressed with Drake releasing music. You've got the Raptors atop the Eastern Conference. You've got Drake atop your top 10 again.
Yeah, the Raptors top my Eastern Conference rankings as well.
There we go. Are they the rankings of the records?
Something like that.
Well, you heard it here first. Reborn and Summer Games, number one songs, co-number one songs of the year. Are you going to be making a playlist of those top 10 songs?
I already have made a playlist of my top 10.
Can you add my top 10 to that playlist?
I think we've done separate ones in the past, so I'll do that. And we'll put those on the post note on Sonic Central website, on the Peltoncast section.
And you should tweet them too.
We'll tweet them as well.
I'll give you the link to, you can tweet my top songs of 2018.
Okay.
Which is not a list that I'm working on often enough. There's so much stuff that gets lost.
Yes.
Okay, so to wrap things up here, a lot of my music listening that happens is not of artists like Drake or Playboi Carti, who I discussed mid-year and took out of my top 10, just because we've already talked about it, right? Most of my music listening that's happened is artists who previously didn't have agents or don't have management, right? Trying to find artists who we could work with as clients.
Yes, you're trying to look for what's next.
So, a lot of times that means that I'm looking and listening to artists who have one or two songs that are out, early stuff. And some of these are that, some of but I wanted to do kind of a top 10 of artists that are just found on the internet. So I'm going to run through these relatively quickly.
Did you end up doing a limit in terms of Spotify plays?
I didn't look at that, no. But I would say that most of these are under or near 1 million plays or less. So first, this is truly, there's a couple of these that are truly rare. But the song Arco by Rossi Rock and Sebi OG. Have you listened to this?
No.
Oh my God, it's good. It's like, I'm going to drive home and listen to it again. This is rap music from San Diego.
The mean streets of San Diego.
And you hear it and you're just like.
That's very South Los Angeles.
This is the most fire, just out of nowhere. And there's not like, I think this dude is signed to, Rossi Rock is signed to like maybe somebody's label of note. I don't know a ton about him, but this song is so good.
Okay.
Changing directions pretty drastically here. I have the song Sin Triangle by Sidney Gish, who is an indie rock artist from the Boston area. And this record, she just released it on her own and put it up on the internet like January 4th of 2018. And she really kind of like...
Wasn't really thinking about best of 2018 list to do it that early.
Wouldn't like really kind of own the first sort of week of music at that time. What are you looking at? Rossi Rock?
No.
Sidney Gish?
Yeah.
Okay. Really kind of own that like first week of music, because there's not a ton of stuff that's coming out around that time period. But this is just like indie pop music that is clever and catchy, and it's great.
Okay.
These are not actually in order. I just typed them in randomly. Number three, I have the song Want You Back by an artist named Spencer. Oh, man, so good. Just like one of those songs that I heard the first time and I was like, I am in. I would say that I'm more of a sucker for this type of song than I am for basically any other kind of music.
I think you're actually thinking of a Himes.
What? Is there a song? Oh, yeah. I am not thinking of a Himes song. Oh, are you making the playlist or are you just looking these up?
I'm just looking these up.
Okay. Next, this one you will not find on Spotify, is the song Eternally by Melanie Faye featuring Mac DeMarco.
Oh.
This song was, Melanie Faye is an Instagram guitar player.
I'm sorry. I understand those words individually. I don't understand them together.
Have we not talked about Melanie Faye?
No, I don't think so.
So, I mean, I went and met with her in LA.
Maybe you did mention then. You didn't use the term Instagram guitar player.
Yeah, there it is. Those three words together. This song was recorded at Mac DeMarco's house, right? Just like in one day, and is not like an official song to any platform, just uploaded to YouTube, and it's just her and Mac DeMarco with like masks on playing in front of his pool or whatever. And it's somehow so good. It's like repetitive and just like gets into this groove. What Melanie Faye is doing, what Melanie Faye will be, incredible. Next, the song might have come out in 2017. I don't know exactly. Officially came out because she ended up signing a major label deal, probably based upon how good the song is the song Black Truck by Mareba. I don't know how that's pronounced. Do you know this song?
No.
Oh my God. A song that definitely, like, she was a completely unknown artist when this came out. Ended up signing to Interscope. And just kind of lingered for the entire year. How good it is. It's like, I don't want to call it, it's not like, it's maybe an R&B song, but it just, it's so good. Listen to it.
Okay.
Next, I have the song Note for Sale by Sudan Archives. What?
That's a name?
You don't know Sudan Archives?
No.
What? Have we talked about nothing?
I don't.
So Sudan Archives is signed to Stone's Throw artist. She's actually a violin player. Huh. And the cool thing about what she does is can shred on violin, but also does this thing, especially live, where she'll basically pull it down and pluck it like a guitar. It's like, that's the mode. Like, really? Stunning artist. Note for Sale was definitely the jam for this year. Next, I have the song Bedford Falls by Ford. This one came out on Odessa's Foreign Family Collective, their record label. It really reminds me of like a Rent song. Like, this, listening to it, and I'm like, this is what the kids are listening to. Like, this is electronic music that the closest thing that I can think of is the like 25,000 whatever hours song.
Oh,
maybe it's not Rent. That's Rent, right?
I don't know.
You know what I'm talking about. Do you not? God. If Mrs. Fantasy Genius was here, she would know exactly what I was talking about.
Yeah.
Probably the most random of the songs on this list is a song called White Girls Black Jacket by The Inning. And like no real profile online at all. But this song definitely hits me. It hits me in my Interpol place. Kind of like early Interpol real estate.
Where is that located?
Oh, it's deep down in there. But it's strong. This song was something that I heard. The thing that we didn't talk about was the prominence of curators, and something that probably has been existing for a long time, but I recently learned of in 2008. But a couple of people who have like very prominent, and I think this one probably, I'm going to guess, came from David Dean Burkhart. And are you seeing any of this? You're doing so much research while I'm talking.
Probably the Rent song is Seasons of Love.
Seasons of Love?
Yes.
Anyway, I saw this one on a YouTube playlist, like a tiny group that, again, hit me in my Interpol place. Next, I have the song One of the Other Girls by an artist named Uda Oda, who's from Sweden?
I'm Ron Bergen.
from a northeastern European country. And this song, just like good vibes electronic music. And last, I have a song that we talked about in our mid-year Pelton cast, Year in Music, and that is the song Confirmation by Westerman. And you might have had this as an honorable mention sort of in your top 10.
Yeah, you brought this up before we started, and I was like, I heard that the other day, and I was like, oh, that is a really good song. But I my top 10 is done. I can't change it now.
Yeah, you listen to the Black Panther soundtrack. And this song, getting into the chorus so casually, right? We definitely had said the exact same back in June or July or whatever. But it's just like, it is the most, like, it just rolls into the chorus so naturally. And it gets there a few times. Nothing about this song feels forced at all. And it's like the really high voice. I talked about how it reminds me of... hearing Westerman's voice hits me in the place that the song Small Town Boy by Bronski Beat is one of my favorite songs of all time.
That's an even more obscure place than your Interpol.
if I was doing, I don't know how deep I would have to get in my favorite songs of all time to get to this track, but it's not that far.
Okay.
So those were 10 songs. We'll put these together on a playlist also.
Of course. And we'll be continuing to listen to new music in 2019 because we're just a year removed from doing this again next year.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.